Part of this workshop involves me talking to you about the five basic symptoms of codependency. Now, I want to repeat something I said earlier, but I just don't think this can be repeated enough, and that is that oftentimes, if you have heard about codependency before and you've started to read some books about it and tune into it, you will find that it's a very confusing experience. Because people talk about symptom after symptom after symptom after symptom. Also in there, although it's very subtle, you will find that there's some blaming done as though we do this kind of thing on a conscious level, or that we have some control over it, which makes you feel terrible. So you got this mush brain with this sinking feeling, and I'd like to help you start to correct some of that, if I may be so bold to say that. I think that it's best if you keep the symptoms down to a manageable number. And in working on this for about 6 years, I have found that they boil down to about five basic issues. And I'm going to talk about those. I would encourage you to focus on them and keep your focus only on them for a while. Now, for those of you who are in a 12-step process, going to ACOA or Al-Anon, or are in recovery and looking at step one of codependency, admitted you are powerless over your codependency, that your life is unmanageable, I would suggest you follow out this written form of a step one. This, in my opinion, if you do it, will take you about 6 months. This isn't something you'll whip out tonight. Because there is so much denial and delusion and minimization about our illness, it's really hard to see until you start focusing and looking and being open. So I'm going to show you how to do that and put your symptoms into the realm of some sort of manageability. Now, treat these five basic symptoms again as issues of powerlessness. That means they happen automatically. Your issues of unmanageability are about what happens after you get into these issues of powerlessness. What are the results of these five basic symptoms in your life? Each one of you will have a different telltale. Each one will have a very different story, although it will be very similar. And you need to find out what your individual story is, because that's the only way you can possibly begin to change some of this. The first major symptom of codependency is low or non-existent self-esteem. On the other hand, the experience of arrogance and grandiosity. Now, I want to remark about this arrogance and grandiosity first. That's about the fact that a person has been taught by their family of origin to put themselves above other people. And in the act of putting themselves above other people, they won't have that sense of shame about them, which keeps them away from the sensing the shame core. In addition to that, these people usually have turned off their feeling reality, so they can't feel the shame anyway because they don't feel their feelings. And so they stand kind of stuck. And this position of arrogance and grandiosity for the codependent is more dysfunctional than being aware that you are experiencing the shame and are feeling less than, by the way. I told you that the shame attack, or the experience of this loss of esteem, or the experience of lost esteem, or the lack of development of esteem, is experienced whenever you have the sense that you are less than. This symptom comes from the experience of the shame core. It comes from being abused. It comes from not being valued by your major caretakers. And as you have it, it constantly tells you again that you are worth less than other people. How to write about that is to be down in this manner. If you are arrogant and grandiose and know it, and know this is a problem, then you need to speak to how you put yourself above others, how you act contemptuously, how you experience being better than others, how you don't feel your feelings, and what that's like. If you're, on the other hand, experiencing the loss of esteem and experience the shame core, then you need to describe your shame attacks. This is critical. Tune into them and begin to get facile at describing the shame attack. They're highly individual, but basically you feel little and less than in some way. When you become aware of it and can start to describe them, talk about when it happens. What happens in your environment that triggers the shame attack? Is it when your boss is critical of you? When your husband refuses to have sex with you or your wife? Is it when you notice your children making mistakes? What happens that will trigger a shame attack in you? Talk about how long it lasts. You can also, if you've developed a real skill at gathering other esteem by how you look and how much money you have and who you know and how well your kids are, and you've learned how to do that, then describe how you gather most of your esteem that way and start write about how that's done. So you can start to see when you're gathering it outside in and that you're not experiencing it inside out. This is the nuts and bolts of beginning recovery. What happens to a person in terms of issues of unmanageability when they cannot esteem themselves from within or have self-esteem or are arrogant and grandiose? These are the kinds of things that you need to be writing about. Now, I'll just list them briefly, but you need to go on into exactly describing these. People that do this and that are on the side of loss of esteem are usually people pleasers, as they work at gathering other esteem. They want to have other people like them so they can gather that esteem outside in, and so they're very nice. They're people pleasers. They have a lot of fear of rejection. And the fear of rejection, again, is even more basic to the shame. They fear rejection because they'll lose that esteem that goes outside in. They also may be about creating a character acceptable to other people. So they get into a lot of need to control self in order to do that. They're very self-controlled people. People pleasers, self-controlled people, super self-controlled people, to create a facade that other people will like. Another factor of this is as they have a shame attack and are feeling little and less than, they'll be immobilized and unable to protect themselves, which is a major issue of unmanageability because as you're in that state, you're subject to being offended. There's a loss of a confidence in the self. But as you are less than and little and shrinking, you're going to lose a confidence in your ability to be who you want to be. You may also put up with abuse inside a relationship that truly is unacceptable to a self-esteeming person because you are always standing, as you have a shame attack, less than the person who's doing the abusing, so you put up with that kind of thing. Lots of issues of unmanageability flow off of that. Constantly seeking approval from others. Crave other people's affirmation. Feel different than others. Every time you have a shame attack, you'll start feeling as though you're from Mars and everybody else is from Earth. And you are very, very different. You also, as you're in a shame attack, won't know that you have rights. And even more seriously, you won't even know you have a right to make a mistake. Again, this drives you into perfectionistic type behavior. You have to be perfect and never make a mistake. You also will feel guilty, which is really more about shame, whenever you stand up for yourself. If you finally get so angry you can't stand it and you really flare into that and take care of yourself and tell the other person exactly what you're thinking because you need to, you will then go into a shame attack or start feeling guilty that you did that. So even when you do take care of yourself, you still lose somewhere down the line. You judge yourself harshly. Have difficulty hearing positive things about yourself. You know, as you truly view yourself as a one-down person, you will have a lot of difficulty even hearing people give you compliments. This is one of the problems Pat and I had, my husband and I had. He'd give me a compliment and I'd never hear it. He'd be critical of me and I'd always hear that. And I would accuse him of never being very nice to me and of being very harsh and judgmental, and he'd say, that's not true, that isn't true. I am, you know, I do tell you what I don't like, but I also tell you what I do like. You aren't listening, you have selective hearing, and then I'd think he was a jerk. This is before I think it's diluted. This is before I had some understanding that I was more the problem than he was in this area. Not only do you judge yourself harshly and have difficulty hearing positives, you also fear, of course, the judgment and criticism of others, because when you hear that, you will go into a shame attack. Work addiction, I think, is oftentimes driven from this. It's about gathering other esteem, that as I get approval, as I gain money, as I gain power, as I gain prestige outside in, I can finally feel good about myself, or think I do anyway. And there's nothing wrong with other esteem, except that it doesn't last. It can be taken from you at any moment. You also get into overreacting to changes. One thing about a codependent is that we are just loath to do any kind of changing. We want to keep things controlled. We find we're very, very rigid. And this is about the shame core, and you need to describe how you do that. It's a real issue of unmanageability. In case you haven't gotten it yet, codependents are extremely difficult to live with. Another issue that I want to talk about, a symptom, is that you have difficulty owning your own reality. Now, your reality is made up again, and I told you I'd refer to this a lot, of four different things: your body, or what you look like, your thinking, or how you give meaning to your environment, your feelings, which is about your emotions, and your behavior, what you do or don't do. You have difficulty owning that. It comes in two forms. A, which is healthier, you know, but you won't tell. B is even more dysfunctional. I don't know what my reality is. This symptom comes from experiencing overt or covert abuse whenever you were expressing your reality as a child. Covert abuse would be about being ignored. Like you walk up to mom and you were crying because you were hurting. That was your reality. You had some pain and she just ignored you, never responded to you. That's about covert or hidden abuse when you are trying to express your reality. Or you may have been attacked, which is about overt abuse. Maybe you were crying and you got beaten for crying. Or maybe you told dad that you didn't like him beating up your mom, and you got attacked for telling him that thought. Or maybe you had the even, I think, even worse experience of having your reality denied. Like maybe your parents did something real gross, and you walked up and you said, "I think that's real gross." And they look at you like, "You're crazy. We just didn't do anything gross. You're having the problem assigning grossness to what we've just done. What we're doing is okay." And you stand there and you go, "I think that was gross, but they're telling me I'm crazy." That is severe abuse. I was working with a woman recently both her parents were sex addicts. I mean, unbelievably out of control with their sexuality. They do it, and then they tell her she was crazy. They not only tell her that what they were doing wasn't that bad anyway, I mean, it wasn't dysfunctional, then they, a little while later, say they didn't do it. Severe abuse. Or maybe you had the experience of being abandoned for your reality. Like my friend who she and her siblings were just simply being needy, you know, and expressing the neediness, you know, with their reality, like maybe crying or busy being kids, and mom would leave. "I can't stand you. You're causing me to go crazy. I'm going to leave, and my leaving is your fault." So the child learned that to express the reality meant abandonment. When you have those kinds of experiences, you will learn to either first not say anything, even though you're aware of it. Later on, if the abuse is very severe, you will detach from your own sense of reality and not have it. How to write this is to do this. You need to look at each part of your reality, all four of them. And then figure out if I am aware of what I look like, and I do share it, so that's not a problem. So you don't need to worry about your body. But maybe when you come to your thinking reality, you know what you think, but you just won't share it. You won't tell anybody what your thoughts are. So your body is okay, thinking is at A, feelings maybe are at B, because you don't know what you feel. You're one of these numb people that doesn't feel their feeling reality. Or maybe it might be certain feelings you don't feel, like you don't feel shame, you don't feel anger, but you do feel pain and fear. So some of them are at A and some of them are at B. And some of them may be even okay. It's like you have that one feeling and you are willing to tell. So basically when it comes to feelings, you need to assess each feeling reality, figure if you can tell it, or if you know and won't tell it, or you don't experience it at all. And about behavior, you need to assess whether you're willing to admit or even aware of whether you can own or not own your own reality in terms of what you do and don't do. Now let me give you some examples of this so you can see what I'm talking about. What I mean is that you write this out. You describe it. That's how you write about this. In terms of your body, what we're talking about is how you look like. If you're an A, you will do this kind of thing. A means you know and won't tell. Somebody will walk up to you and say, "My, you're sure looking nice today." Now you know you look nice. But instead of admitting that and telling them, "Yeah, I know I look nice today. Isn't this suit great? I really enjoy it. I enjoy wearing this." You will say something to distract them, you know, change the subject, or you won't respond, or you'll tell them how tacky this suit is that you're wearing and how it's got a hole in the hem, how you got it at the Salvation Army for $3. And it's not true I look nice today because I got 4 pimples out here. I'm just covering it with makeup. And yeah, I got buck teeth. And by the time you get done, you know you look all right, but that person has no idea you know that. If you're at B with what you look like, that is about not knowing truly what you look like. Now, I still hover down around B. When I look in the mirror, I can't tell what I look like. Some people have this so severely that they don't have a face in the mirror. And when I look in the mirror, who I see is my father. It's really terrible because I hate the son of a gun. So I look in the mirror, I don't really, I've really given it up, but there's part, I don't like him. I don't. So when I look in, this is terrible. I look in the mirror, I see him, and then I don't like me. I can't see myself clearly in the mirror. Another example of being at B with your body is with an eating disorder like an anorexic that weighs 80 pounds and looks in the mirror and sees herself or himself as fat. That's an example of this. Or somebody who's obese but looks in the mirror and sees Cinderella. That's about not knowing what you look like. I had Pat sent somebody to my office about a year ago. He said, "I want you to assess this woman for an eating disorder. She's obese." I said, "Well, how could somebody not?" He said, "Just assess it, Pia." This woman walked into my office. She weighed 200 pounds and was 5'3". And I didn't know that that's who she was. I didn't know who she was. She just came and said, I said, "What can I do for you?" She said, "You need to assess me." I said, "For what?" "An eating disorder." And I looked at her, and then I realized what Pat had done. I said, "Are you the lady I'm supposed to assess?" And she said, "Yes." I said, "Are you aware you're obese?" "No." "What do you mean I'm obese?" I said, "Tell me how much you think you ought to weigh." She says, "I'm fine at 200. I'm svelte." She just thought that was, she had no understanding that she was obese. None whatsoever. That was my very first experience with that. She was at B. She had no concept of how large her body was. The other one has no concept of how small it is. Somebody else like me has no concept of even what they look like. Or they see somebody else in the mirror. It's a very, very, very serious issue. Where you see this happening, for the most part, is with people who have been sexually abused. Victims of incest and child molestation have a terrible time knowing what they look like. Sometimes this is the very first symptom that puts the therapist on alert that they've got an incest or an incest survivor or somebody who's been molested, and it's that very first symptom that's indicative that somebody's got this problem buried somewhere in a dissociative memory. I'm an incest survivor. If you're, in terms of your thinking and assessing where you are, if you can own it, don't worry about it. If you can own it, you know, as you have thoughts and people ask you or as you need to say, you can do that. But if you're at A and somebody asks you what you're thinking, you'll say, right, somebody says, "What do you think about what Harry just did?" And you'll say in your head, "I think Harry's a jerk." But you'll smile at the person and say, I'm not going to let them know. See, smile at that and carry it's very nice. It's like you know, but you'll be doggone if you'll tell anybody about it. But if you're at B, somebody asks you what you're thinking, what happens is you go in confusion, your mind goes blank, and you can't talk about what you're thinking. If it's about your feelings and you're at no one won't tell, you'll experience your feelings, but you'll be doggone if you'll tell anybody. Or certain ones you won't tell. Like, I don't like to admit I'm angry. That is the one feeling reality I absolutely do not want to talk about. And sometimes I move down into B and don't even know I'm angry. But a lot of times, well, it hovers back and forth, actually. The rest of them I feel and I can talk about. But that one, I hover back and forth between here and occasionally admit to it. Behavior, that's about what I do or don't do. If I know but won't tell what that is when somebody asks me whether I've done it or not done it, I won't tell them. Like if they say, did you do it? And I know I didn't, I'll say yes. This is about lying. This is about chronic lying. Or if I didn't do it, and they ask me if I didn't do it, I don't want them to know that, so I tell them I did, even when I didn't and I know I didn't. I'm aware that I'm lying, but I don't want somebody to know anything about my behavior. From that, I don't know. That means I don't know what I've done or not done. Somebody said, do you do it? I can't tell them because I don't know. I space it out. I have no awareness of what I do or don't do. This is the one thing you'll see this surfacing in treatment center all the time, where family comes and tells the person what their behavior has been. And the person is deluded about it, doesn't even know they've done some things. You know, they've repressed it, or they've been in a blackout, or they just will not acknowledge that that's part of it. They need the family to come and break them loose off of that. So writing about this is assessing and describing how it's dysfunctional. The part that works well and that you do is more. You don't need to worry about it. The part that doesn't, you need to write about it. What kind of problems can you get into when you experience not being able to own your own reality? The main one is the loss of intimacy or the difficulty establishing or being intimate. The next most important one is about a loss of a sense of self. You know, in order to have a sense about yourself, you have to own your own reality. As you don't own parts of it, you will lose a sense of self and you will feel empty. Feeling empty and crazy are two of the predominant ways a codependent will first present themselves when they don't know they're codependent. They'll just tell a therapist, I feel empty and I'm crazy. I'm crazy. You might as well just lock me up right now. There's issues of control that come out of this. Let me explain this. If I can't own who I am, this is a funny one. When you lose a sense of self, you don't know who you are. You can get into controlling off of this issue. It goes like this. I don't know who I am. I have to rely on you to tell me who I am in order to know who I am. Now I know who I want to be, so I'm going to have to control what you think of me in order to be who I want to be. That's control. You can also get into addictive relationships with this kind of thing. You know, getting into dependent, addictive relationships, you have to have someone in your life telling you you're okay in order to be okay. You can also get into resenting others because they don't notice and identify your feeling reality. This is the person at A, they know and won't tell, but keep expecting their spouse to notice whatever that feeling reality is and verbalize it for them. Get into resentments when your spouse won't do that and identify your reality for you. Without feelings, without experiencing your feeling reality, certainly you will also lose the sense of aliveness and ability to be spontaneous and have fun. As you are aware of your feeling reality but denying them or out of touch with them, you will experience explosive episodes of them surfacing. They will be experienced in the form of depression or rage attacks, that sort of thing, or panic attacks. These feelings may surface in the form of illness, such as cancer, arthritis, heart disease, hypertension, dermatitis, disorders of the skin, migraine, headaches, all that kind of thing. We also will have difficulty having fun because we don't allow ourselves to have feelings about what's going on, and you just have a sense that you're kind of joyless or kind of just kind of bleh. We also can get into using drugs to medicate the unexpressed pain and anger and fear or shame. Of course, this gets into major acts of dishonesty as we have to deny who we are. We can lose our jobs as a result of that. We can lose relationships as a result of our dishonesty. We can lose ourselves as a result of our dishonesty. So write about that. Those are issues of unmanageability.
This is the end of Side 1. For more valuable information, turn cassette over now and continue to listen on Side 2. Do not fast forward.
The third major symptom is that we have difficulty experiencing or owning our own needs and wants. This comes in two forms also. A is I know, but won't take care of. The second one is I don't know. That I am not aware of my needing or my wanting. This is more serious than A. Where this comes from is from being attacked or ignored, for having your neediness attacked or ignored or denied. That as a child, when you were busy being needy and dependent, if you got attacked for your neediness, if your needs were ignored, or if your needs were denied, then you would learn to start either ignoring them, being aware but not doing anything about them, or starting to ignore and eventually not having any needs or wants. It's very directly related to that issue of dependency needs and wanting. How you would see this acted out in terms of unmanageability would be in terms of neediness, you would certainly get unnecessary illness. You know, you have a need to go to the doctor or get medical attention when you get sick. If you're at not even being aware you're sick, or you're here, you know you're sick, but you don't take any action about it to do anything better, what's going to happen is you're going to get sicker and sicker and sicker and sicker. So it finally either gets your attention, you move from B to A, or you finally know you've got to do something to take it. You're going to have a lot of unnecessary serious illness as a result of that. That's a major issue of unmanageability in this area. Also, you'll experience only getting your needs met passively, so you get very few of them met because you're not doing it. Or you'll experience getting very little of what you want because you either don't know what you want or you won't tell anybody what you want. One of the common things to see two codependent people do when they're married is they'll do something like this. They'll say to the other one, what do you want for Christmas? Well, I don't know. What do you want? Well, I don't know. What do you want? I don't know. Well, let's not buy anything for Christmas this year. Or they'll do this thing, where do you want to go to eat, dear? I don't know. Where do you want to go to eat? I don't know. Where do you want to go to eat? It's like nobody can make the decision about wanting. Nobody wants. It's terrible. Now, how to write about this is this. You need to take each individual issue and apply whether you're at A or B with each one. Needs is more difficult. What you want to do is write down all those dependency needs I listed before: food, clothing, shelter, physical nurturing, medical, dental, attention, and your need for time, attention, and direction from other people. See if you're at no one won't tell or at B with each one of those needs. Then write about the ones that are either at A or B, the ones you take care of and you're aware of and there's no problem, ignore that. But the ones that you are flopping around at A or B, start writing about how you know you flop around about that. If it's wants are different, wants are about preferences. These are things you don't have to have, but just kind of bring some joy and pleasantness to life. If you're at B, you don't want. If you're at A, you know what you want, you just won't get it. But there's another problem here, too, that's about codependency, and that's about being completely wanting everything you want. People that generally are into this experience are the kind of people that lived in a home where none of their needs were taken care of, for physical nurturing and for, you know, their focal needs and that sort of thing, but everything they ever want, they got. So they're not about being wantless as an adult. All they do is take care of their wants and they ignore their needs. That's a special little quirk. Those people come into the treatment center, they're extremely hard to treat because, you know, they just blow everything out their wazoo. And they don't have a clue about how to take care of their needs. And, like, I have to make rounds of the property and all that and the brooms and all that. Talk about finding out who's a wanter and who's a needer. These people have no idea how to address their needs. They live like they're 5 years old in that bedroom. Their bedroom looks like a cyclone hit it. They have no idea how to take care of themselves. All they know is how to get what they want. They don't have a clue about this. So there's a quirk here. You may not be wantless. You may be wanting everything, getting everything, and completely self-indulgent. That's just the opposite end of the continuum. But it is about codependency. So you write about that, if that's the problem. It's not about not wanting anything or even knowing. It's a third thing. That's all I'm aware of, my wanting. Okay, issues of unmanageability. I started some of them. I'll repeat a few more. Another thing that can happen is getting into profound resentments. If you won't acknowledge your needs and your wants, you'll feel resentful and blame the other person for not acknowledging your needs and wants and doing something about that. You can get into very specifically lacking certain things in your life. Like if you can't take care of your clothing needs, like your clothing needs never gotten taken care of, and now you don't even, you may be at B and not even aware of what you need to get in terms of clothing, or you may be at A, you know what you need to do, but you won't make yourself get it. So you have major issues in the area of clothing or food. It might be that you don't know how to eat, and you're at B. You don't know anything about eating, and so you eat very unhealthily, and maybe you can get into an eating disorder as a result of some of this. Or maybe you know what you're supposed to eat, but you don't eat it anyway. Maybe about physical nurturing. You don't know how to ask. This is one thing I did. I was at B with my... I didn't know when I needed physical nurturing. How I first became aware of that was with my husband. What I noticed is that every night I'd pick a fight. If I were cooking, he'd be sitting on the couch doing his crossword puzzle, playing with his parrot and watching TV. And every night I'd find myself at the opening of the living room fighting. I mean, picking a fight. He'd sit there and look up at me like, what is she doing? And I didn't know what I was doing. I was just creating this fight. Finally, one day he said to me, why don't you come over, sit on the couch, and give you a hug. And I don't know why. I said, oh, I know. I came, sat down, and gave me a hug. I felt better, got up, and went out to the kitchen. And I was real confused because I felt better, and I didn't know what happened. Now, it dawned on me when I was standing at the stove, you know what? Doing that in the hallway was about needing a hug, wanting to feel more important than that parrot who hated me, by the way, and the TV and the crossword puzzle, wanting to be more important and wanting him to give me physical nurturing to demonstrate that, to get away from that parrot, because he couldn't hug me with the thing on his shoulder. He used to sit on the shoulder and lick his face. It'd be real nice, you know, and then I'd walk by and it would try to bite me. If I tried to talk, it would scream. So anyway, but what I needed to do was say, I just need a hug, would you give me a hug? Instead of doing that, I wasn't aware of it, so I'd pick a fight to eventually get the hug I wanted. This can get absolutely screwball and create a lot of chaos in relationships. But anyway, not taking care of your neediness can create gross issues of unmanageability in your life. You need to go down through each one and see how in terms of the results of this, taking a look at that. They're highly individual. The fourth symptom is the one my husband thinks is the symptom. He thinks all the rest spin off of these. And this one, it took him years to get my attention over. It's called operating in the extreme. We as codependents operate in the extreme. Now, my husband first identified this for me by telling me I had no rheostats. I was all on or all off. Nothing in between. What this is a lack of understanding of moderation. we don't understand how to be moderate. In fact, moderation for us seems boring and uncomfortable, and it's like we haven't responded enough to the situation. In ACA stuff, they talk about this particular symptom as not understanding normal. And it is true. That's that symptom that it does relate to. I still don't know what normal... I don't know what normal is as applied to me. I know what normal is applied to you, but when I try to think about normal myself, it escapes me. This comes from the experience of only having your parents demonstrate extreme ways of thinking and behaving and feeling in front of you. And what you do is you have two choices when that's happened. You can model the behavior or do this thing that most codependents do. They don't like what mom and dad did on this end of the continuum, so they go to the other end of the continuum to do the opposite of what mom and dad did. But all they're doing is operating in the extreme on the other end of the continuum. So, for example, we may have grown up in a family where physical abuse was the rule and we got beaten for every little thing we did, so we grew up, we're not going to do that. But we don't opt for a moderate form of discipline with our children, flat hand on a covered bottom, with consequences. We go way to this end extreme and we don't discipline them at all. So as we were coward and perfect, our kids are wild and unmanageable because we don't discipline them. We don't make them follow the rules. Now, in order to write about this, you need to see that in terms of your reality, this symptom is seen on all levels of your reality. Body, thinking, feeling, and behaving. You need to check out each part of your reality and see if you're doing this on any level. With your body, it's about dressing in the extreme. Like, for example, and this is especially true for a sexually abused a person that's been molested or incest as a child. You find people that have had that happen will be dressing so that you cannot tell anything about them. They're dressed up to their neck and down to their toes in big baggy things, and so you can't see anything. Or they're dressing to blend, so when you look at them, they kind of disappear into the wall. Or on the other end, they're dressing so that you know exactly what they look like, and they're barely dressed. That's an example of operating in the extreme. It is about abuse. It actually is about boundaries. But anyway, one or the other, about hiding or being too seen, too much seen. About your thinking reality, this is about, do you think in the extreme? Like all solutions are seen in black, white, right, wrong. Or that you take, as you give meaning to stuff that comes into your brain, you take every single thing literally. This happened to me a lot. I had to write about this. My husband's a very facetious man, and when we got married, I was very literal. And he'd say something facetious, and I'd take it for sure. And he couldn't be funny with me, you know. He'd say something, and he'd be laughing and think it's real, and I'd be taking it literally. And he'd look at me, and I'd just be going, you know, what's going on here? It would be very, I'd take it very literally, and then he'd look at me like I was crazy. Like, how could you ever think that that's true? This is obviously the composed in the extreme. It's facetious. And I'd look at him and say, I don't understand facetious. Everything's concrete and literal to me. Solutions are perceived in the extreme. It's like some little thing would happen, and I'd take a baseball bat to correct it. Like a fly would come in the house, I wouldn't pick a fly swatter to hit it. I'd take a baseball bat and crush the kitchen sink. Like Pat would come in and say, you know, I don't like the fact that you just took my coffee cup and washed it before I was done. And the next thing that would fly out of my mouth would be, when are we getting divorced? You get it? Solutions are seen in the extreme, like there's no moderation there. There's lots to this. You'll be riding a long time. You'll have the bent elbow. Feelings are experienced in the extreme. You need to write about that. That's about carried feelings or induced feelings. So you need to write about shame attacks, panic attacks, rage attacks, hopelessness attacks, or suicide attacks. You need to describe those. That's how you write that one. That's where the disease is seen in the most extreme and the sickest. Or you behave in the extreme. You either trust everybody in the world or you trust nobody at all. You let everybody in the world touch you, you don't let anybody trust you, touch you at all. You discipline your kids to the extreme, you don't discipline them at all. Now, here's the one This one got my attention. It's kind of funny, but it was a miserable experience what was going on. I'll tell it real fast because I don't want to go over the time limit. But anyway, my husband came in and confronted me one day with leaving too many lights on in the house. Now, I operated in the extreme because I responded by crying. Now, that's about behavior done in the extreme. Prior to recovery, whenever he confronted me, I either whine and snivel and cry, or I'd be on the other end of the extreme in a rage attack wanting to kill him, one or the other. Whining and sniveling, raging. That's an example of behaving in the extreme. But anyway, I cried. And he kind of looked at me, scratched his head, and sat down. And then pretty soon he got up, went to the back of the house. Then I got up and decided I had to go into the bathroom, so when I got up, I shut off all the lights. All lights in the living room, all lights in the dining room, all lights in the kitchen, the hall light, went in the bathroom, didn't bother turning that on because I was afraid I wouldn't turn it off. And besides, who needs the light on to do what I had to do in there anyway? So I sat down in there, got 30 seconds of relief when I heard this bump, bump, bump come up the hallway, and I knew I was in trouble, but would you believe I didn't know quite what it was? Yeah. Couldn't get it. Anyway, then I heard him turning on all those lights, and I realized what it was, and I hid in the bathroom. Pretty soon he found me in there in the dark, scared him. He jumped. And he said, "What are you doing in here?" And I said, "What do you think?" And he said, "Well, what are you doing in the dark?" And I said, "Well, the light." And he goes, "There you go, Pia. You don't have any rheostats. Hun, don't you know what moderation is?" And I just say, "No." So he went outside to put the dogs away. I got up, went and sat in my wing chair, and a light bulb went on. I thought, okay, I leave too many on or I turn them all off. Now, why don't, Pia, you start acting moderate and figure out the number of lights on in that house that would be moderate? So I did what any codependent recovery would do. I counted them all up, divided them in a third, and I let a third blazing. I decided that would be moderate. Reality right here. I don't remember how many I said, and like any other codependent, since we are about keeping score and all that, I waited for him to say something to me, and he did. But I had been leaving a moderate number on, so it took quite a while. Finally, one day he came in and said, "You're leaving too many lights on." I said, "No, I'm not. Six are on, that's enough." I'm sure he got it. I can say it like that. And he looked at me for a minute, and then he smiled. And then I told him what I was doing. You see, and that's recovery for me. And he couldn't say anything about that. I said, "You know, Pat, if you think too many are on, go shut them off. Don't shut this one off because I'm using it. But that's your problem, not mine. See, I own my own thinking reality over here, and I was acting moderately." So you need to write about how you flap out there. And you need to understand that that is not appropriate. And that the problem isn't the person you live with. It's you. Also, when you get into recovery with this one, whenever you're acting moderately for a very long time, it'll always feel, again, like you're not doing it right. Now, the issues of unmanageability born off this symptom is that anybody living with you will think you're crazy or chaotic. People living with you will also experience the relationship with you as unstable, unpredictable, and if you're about threatening abandonment all the time as a solution to the problems you're having, they're going to experience that threat of abandonment and sense the relationship is highly unstable and eventually leave you. That's too painful. Unless they're highly codependent or hanging on. You inside will experience confusion about what normal is and have to guess at it all the time. Write about that. Others will perceive you when you're thinking in the extreme as being rigid, judgmental, and abusive on one hand, but if you're operating in the other extreme, they'll experience you as being wishy-washy with no opinions and you being kind of a victim, one or the other. That has harmful consequences. People don't like you, they leave, or they abuse you. Issues of unmanageability. Also, you can wind up abusing the ones you love. You know, if you behave in the extreme, you will abuse them or neglect them. So lots of issues of unmanageability off this. The main one really is unstable relationships. The fifth symptom I want to talk about is about boundaries. If I had to tell you what really are the most important, in my opinion, it's the first one and the fifth one. Boundary issues are phenomenally important. What I'm seeing here is that codependents reflect the boundaries that the parents have. They're out of a dysfunctional system, that it means that the parents don't have good boundaries. And they are seen, they will reflect this kind of boundary system. They won't have one, it'll be none. And they stand in life getting offended because there's complete lack of protection when you don't have boundaries. Or you will stand in life as a codependent behind a system of walls. That is not a boundary, it's walls. Walls are made up of fear or anger. Now, this offers complete protection because nothing goes in at all. You're protected. You're behind an armor, and you stand like that, fully protected but unable to be intimate. Or you stand in life with a damage system reflected by holes in your boundary. That's partial protection. So that part of the time you're not protected, but part of the time you are. It isn't unusual for people to flop between none and walls. It isn't unusual, especially for a chemically dependent, codependent, to drink their walls away or drink themselves into walls. If you go in a bar and they got a wall of anger around and they have a few shots of whiskey and pretty soon they move into nothing and try to be sexual with everything in the bar.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That was a lot. Would you mind just saying that again?
Okay, you want me to say again what I just said, but which one? What,
well,
backing up to
whole,
where?
The whole concept, the whole issue.
Okay, I'll tell you what. The next lecture is about going way into boundaries, so then it'll explain this, okay? Because you're not going to be able to pick it up right off the bat like this. But what I'm saying to you is that codependents have boundary issues. They are either too protected or not protected enough. Another point here is that when the codependent stands with no kind of boundary at all, it's not only do they lack protection, they're also set up to being an offender. The person that stands without any kind of boundary is the person that is set up to be an adult victim or an adult offender. Both the victim and the offender have no boundaries. It's the same problem, except one, you get attacked, the other, you do the attacking because you don't have any boundaries and you don't respect anybody else's because you can't conceive it. You're not aware that other people have a right to boundaries. And again, this symptom comes from the child, now as an adult, mimicking or reproducing the kind of boundary system their dysfunctional parents have. What kind of issues of unmanageability can you get into as a result of this? Many. The main ones are that you stand in life as a victim or an offender or both. Some of us waffle back and forth. And this is seen in all four areas of abuse. You can be a physical offender or a physical victim. You can be a sexual offender or a sexual victim. You can be an emotional offender or get emotionally abused. Or it could be about spiritually offending and spiritually abusing. There is, along with this first symptom, I told you that difficulty owning your reality, there's a loss of intimacy because you have to own your reality to be intimate. There's loss of intimacy also on the boundary issue. To gain intimacy, you have to do boundary repair work and also own your own reality. But moving on into boundaries, you need an emotional boundary in order to be intimate. Now, I'm going to explain that to you later on. But anyway, right now, I want you to understand there's just a loss of intimacy whenever you do not experience your emotional boundary. When you've lost another component to your boundary that's called your spiritual boundary, which has to do with protecting your thinking, you will lose your ability to maintain your own thinking. You'll have difficulty making decisions. If you've created walls instead of a boundary, you're going to experience a lot of feelings of loneliness and craziness. You're going to feel isolated and afraid a lot, depending upon what kind of wall you're creating. If you have a general loss of a boundary system, you'll be frightened by angry people and authority figures because you won't have that sense of how to protect yourself from that. You also could have a loss of personal morality, especially with the loss of the sexual boundary. There's big consequences as a result of this kind of boundary being damaged. Now, what to do and how to write about that? Well, you have to go down and assess each part of your boundary system. There's four parts. Don't worry about writing this down right now, because I'm going to go into a major lecture on this. There are four components to your boundary system, though: a physical and a sexual and an emotional and a spiritual intellectual component. There's four of them. What you have to do is assess the condition of each component of your boundary system and then write about why you think it is in that condition. That's how you write this step out. Now I'm going to help you do that with this next lecture. Okay? And this is the end of this lecture.